The fool may think he's a wise man, but the wise man knows what a fool he's been. I'm Paul Falcone, and welcome to the Pro Fools Podcast. I'm joined by Greg Thompson, Rick Slater, Dasan Broadnox, and Tim McGrath. The Pro Fools Podcast is brought to you by The Residence Studios. The Residence Studios is a destination studio located in Central Long Island, 1 hour from Manhattan, 1 hour to the Hamptons. We offer a state-of-the-art recording and mixing studio, photo and video facilities with hotel-like amenities, 5 minutes from the beach and minutes away from Long Island's major attractions. Contact us at theresidencestudios@gmail.com or Instagram at theresidencestudios. All right, let's do it.
Welcome to the podcast, episode 2. I'm joined by Rick Slater, Greg Thompson, Dasan, and Paul Falcone. Let's just go around and give a little intro for everybody since we have a guest today.
New guy, Dasan Broadnax. I am freelance audio engineer. Lately, I've been doing some audiobook restoration sweetening, but I also mix for friends and clients and things like that. And then I'm also a home studio artist. So I work from home, recording my own stuff, experimenting, and all that other sort of stuff. And I graduated from SAE, which is how I met Paul.
I'm Paul. I'm happy to be on the second episode here. I've been a freelancer, you know, about 20, 25 years. I came up through the large format studio system. I started as an intern, been putting a studio together right here in Long Island called The Residence Studios, enjoying the spring weather and busting my ass getting our website together today, which is the pro-foolspodcast.com. Again, that website is the pro-foolspodcast.com. By the time you're hearing this, it will be ready to go. So if you're listening, please check it out.
I'm Greg Thompson. I've been a freelance audio engineer most of my career, spanning about 25 years. I'm currently located in Rochester, New York, where I work for the Eastman School of Music. In addition, I do a lot of broadcast television for Good Morning America, ABC Television, and The View. I got my start doing live video captures for America Online back before there was a YouTube. We used to do sessions at AOL, and I recorded a couple of hundred episodes live in the studio with a bunch of famous artists.
Hey there, I'm Rick Slater. I've come up through the large format recording studios of Midtown Manhattan. Taught at SAE, which is where we met. Glad to be aboard.
I think tonight, let's talk a little bit about plugins. I think just to get the ball rolling, you know, what are some plugins, some go-tos for you guys?
Go-tos for me, I use Logic, and the Logic stock stuff is great. So the Echo in Logic, I really enjoy. The compressor in Logic, I really enjoy. The auto filter in Logic is also a good one. Tremolo in Logic is cool too. But the Logic stock stuff, like, I can't get behind enough. Like, it's great. I have Waves bundle, so I use some of the Waves stuff as well. And then I have a pretty big collection of plugins, but the Logic stock stuff is what I'm always going to, like every time.
I just want to quickly interject with what you're saying there, Dasan, because that's something when we talked initially about bringing up plugins, that's one thing I was going to bring up, because I'm a Pro Tools user. I mix everything in Pro Tools, and all my professional work is done in Pro Tools. Yes, I do use Logic. The one thing I do have to say, if you were to compare the stock plugins that you get on an Avid system versus the stock plugins that you get in Logic, I do find the Logic, like you said, the compressor, the EQ, even the reverbs are much more musical sounding than the stock Pro Tools ones. I have a suite of all sorts of plugins that I use, some Avid. I can get into some of the, you know, stock Pro Tools plugins that I do like. But if you were to say, what can you buy just off the shelf and not buy anything else? Logic gets you a lot further than Pro Tools does. That's really interesting that you said that.
That is true.
I don't want to get quite into what my go-to plugins are just yet. I mean, maybe, Greg, were you saying you had a little something about people buying new people getting into plugins?
Well, yes. The first thing I think people should do is they should use the stock plugins and get to know them and really get to know the tools that are available to you before you start getting into buying the flavor of the month plugin. You use what you've got and figure out where you've got holes in your setup, whether it's like, God, I don't have any good reverbs, or, you know, oh man, this stock de-esser is not moving me. I find that is very helpful. Among the online broadcasters that I worked with, I spent about a year or two with Clear Channel, and they had put in a really big Pro Tools setup with an Icon desk. They hadn't put any plugins in the system, so it was just all stock plugins. You know, it was a live concert recording. We turned around the next day, and I was stuck with, like, the standard stuff that comes with Pro Tools. Like, my best compressor was, like, the Purple 1176, or the Blackface, the standard Blackface 1176. And then beyond that, you know, if I wanted to do a limiter across my 2-mix, it was Maxim.
Yeah.
You know, and it was Deverb. Deverb was my reverb.
I love that reverb plugin. I'll get into that in a minute. Yeah. But I got to say, that is one of the most underrated algorithmic reverb plugins out there.
So, Dasan, have you used any other softwares like Logic always been your go-to?
In my school, we had Mac, and they had Logic just preloaded on all of those Macs. So I got introduced to GarageBand and Logic like at that time when I was like 12 or 13. So it was natural for me to just like getting to know it, and I've just stuck with it. But I also have Pro Tools. I've used Ableton a bit, but Logic is the one where it's like I've been using this for years, so I'm the fastest on it and the most acquainted with that software.
For
so
sure. Just, Apple makes it easy.
Yeah, exactly. That's the one for me that how Paul is with Pro Tools, like that's how I am with Logic. I'll live and die by it. Like that's my program.
Now, you see, that's another interesting point that you bring up because I've been using Pro Tools since, the first version I owned was version 3. So people talk about how into Pro Tools I am. I bought Logic pretty early on too, but I was into Pro Tools well before I was into using Logic. I would go back to Pro Tools when it was called Sound Tools before there was a multi-track version of it. It was just a 2-track editor. I never used version 1, but I did use version 2. And the first version that I owned was version 3 with Pro Tools. First an Audio Media 2 card and then Pro Tools 2 hardware. So yeah, I go back a long time with this program since before like you could actually run real-time plugins in Pro Tools. So that's part of the reason why I'm so married to it. And that kind of goes back to what Greg is saying. You know, learn what you have really well first. When people talk about wanting to buy flavor of the month type plugins or they feel like every time they have to do something, they need to go out and buy another plugin. What I tell them is it's kind of like being an artist and being offered every colored pencils, every colored paint, every colored piece of paper, every art supply you could possibly think of, where do you begin when you have that many art supplies available to you? But if someone hands you a bunch of white paper and 12 colored pencils, you'll immediately get down to making art. You know, you have to take the tools that you have and utilize them to the best of your ability. When I think of the short list of plugins that I use, it is really the same set of plugins that I've been using for years. And I will occasionally try out like a new EQ or a new compressor. And oftentimes I'll use them for a little while and go right back to the ones that I've been using all along. Because as long as it works, you know, as long as it's getting the job done, unless there's something that's truly new out there, I have no reason to really move on to newer plugins. And that Bomb Factory 1176 that you're talking about, Greg, is an amazing compressor plugin.
Oh yeah.
You know, it's simple. It's very simple, and it just gets the job done. I know I'll prefer that over the stock. What is it? It's called Dynamics 3 now that comes with Avid or Dyne 3. I don't find that particularly useful, just like I don't find the Avid EQ particularly useful. I find them just to not sound all that great. But the EQ and compressor that I do use predominantly are the first EQ and compressor I ever bought for Pro Tools, which is the Focusrite D2 and D3. They're not modeled after the Red Series. They look like the Red Series, but they're not modeled plugins. Mm-hmm. What I like about them is they just very simply get the job done. Like the EQ sounds good. It sounds musical. I can always get the results that I more or less want out of it unless I want something a little more colorful. And the compressor, similarly to the BF76, similarly to the DBX160X we were talking about last week, it just compresses. It gets the job done, you know, particularly well. It stays out of the way. It doesn't sound too crazy when you hit it really hard. And if you use it subtly, it gets the job done subtly.
You know, a lot of times I think it really boils down to ears, what somebody's hearing in their head.
Yep.
It's not a plug-in situation, but I had a friend who had a small studio with the modular digital recorders. He had a Tascam DA38s, and he had a Mackie 32-way console, and he mixed this band, and he got all sorts of attention at major labels, and they were really knocked out by the quality of the work. And I was rehearsing with a partner of mine. He's had a very storied career and done all sorts of huge multi-platinum artists. And he kept thinking that we were like trying to pull one over that, you know, he's like, come on, you mixed this on an SSL, right? And I'm like, no, the guy mixed it on a Mackie using like B-level, you know, Alesis and low-level lexicon reverbs and stuff. And he just turned the knobs until he got what he wanted out of it. And it sounded awesome.
Yeah, it's the ears. It's not the gear.
Yeah.
Yeah. Rick, you bring up a good point. I feel like the sound could probably relate. If you're newer, it's like, how do you know this sounds good? You're kind of just going off your ear. You guys have experience, so it's different.
Well, you know, like my friend came at it a different way. Like he didn't start like Paul and I did and learn at the feet of people who were making hit records. He just like built a rehearsal studio and then along the way built a recording studio, you know, and just asked a lot of people questions and stuff. The bottom line was that he heard the final sound in his head and he just figured out a way to get that out of his head and into the speakers. And it wasn't like he had a real solid education in audio. So I don't think anyone should feel like, oh, because I didn't go to audio school or I didn't work at a mega recording studio in LA or New York or Nashville, that they can't. They can. They really can.
You're 100% right, Rick. I totally agree with one of the points that you just made. Like, how do you know where you're going with this? You know, you can go to Guitar Center, pick up any couple of pieces of gear, or just download software from the internet and get a pretty good feature set of plugins. How do you know when to use them all? I think what you said is super important, that it's like you have to have an idea in your head of where you're going to and do what you need to do to get there. That's a great point.
Back when I was working at the Hit Factory, we could get what we called practice time in the control rooms. And I would take the same reel of 2-inch from room to room to room. And so I have a project, you know, a song that I mixed on an 80, what was that Bruce Wedeen console? It was like an 80,
68?
48 or something. Wasn't an 80, 68, but it had 1066 channel strips.
You're talking about that little tiny Neve?
In E.
The one it was in E. That console was amazing.
Oh,
that console sounded incredible.
I know. I was so sad to see it go for sale online.
I just have to say, just interrupt you quickly.
Yeah.
They sold that console to replace it with a Pro Tools controller, and I can remember thinking that is the best console ever to have next to a Pro Tools rig. Like, why would you get rid of that console? That?
Yeah.
You know, it was like a 16-channel Neve console with the tape return section.
Yeah.
Anyway, that was
yeah. And that room was hilarious because there were no EQ points between 220 and 700. None. Because the only other EQ in the room was Pultex.
Wow. I never thought of it. That's really
interesting. Because I yelled at Troy about that. I was like, well, not yelled. I complained. I said, dude, we need some EQs to, you know, somewhere between. A lot of people like to cut those frequencies.
You can rent it.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, on the Pultex, so, all you got to do is set it to 100 and then hit attenuate and boost at the same time, and you'll notch out 400.
It'll do that thing. You do that thing.
That's funny.
But I had taken.
Oh, sorry. Sorry.
That's okay. I love the sideshows. So I had taken the same 2-inch, and I was learning all the different automation systems and getting to know all the different consoles and all the different rooms. But all my mixes came out sounding like I mixed it. And the same thing has happened to me where I worked at The View. And at Good Morning America, Good Morning America originally had an API legacy console with a bunch of outboard. And then at The View, the desk was a profile. It still is a profile. And you would listen to mixes that I did, you know, live for air. You can't tell which one was done on the analog desk and which one was done on the digital desk. It was just, I turned the knobs till it sounded good for me.
Yeah, just looking up articles and stuff I read online, and I came across something recently, and it was like, the only 7 plugins you'll ever need. And I was just talking to Paul about it before, and, you know, he was kind of laughing. There's a lot of stuff.
What were they?
What were the plugins that they were talking about?
I think it was gating, limiters, reverb, delay, compression, EQ. I think that was it.
I think the problem is, there are too many things. People get too wrapped up in, what are we going to use? It's like, who cares? You know, when somebody listens to it, they either like it or they don't. They're not judging on what you use.
What I often tell people is, you know, when you play something for a listener, the only thing they really care about is what it sounds like coming through the speakers. Because people have a tendency to want to either make excuses for what they're playing or tell you all about all the cool gear that they use to make that happen. And I try and tell people, like, nobody cares. They just care if it sounds good, if it feels good, if it's something that they want to hear. Nobody wants to hear that you mixed it on an SSL or mixed it in Pro Tools or used analog tape or used this fancy new plugin. When I think about GoTo plugins, there are plugins that I generally use in almost every session, you know, and I will kind of set up for as a session template. Like I said, for my EQ and compressor, like I think of the Focusrite D2 and D3 as the Pro Tools console EQ and compressor. You know, I use the Waves de-esser almost all the time. That's my de-esser. That's like, if it was a piece of analog gear, it would be the FS902. People, you know, a lot of time give me criticism for this, but I use the Waves L2 as my limiter.
Yeah.
And a lot of people will say the L2 smashes all the transients. And maybe it does. I've been using that L2 forever. You know, when I look at my mixes, the transients don't look smashed.
But maybe, you know, you figured out a way to use it that gets what you want and it works. You know what I mean?
Sure. Yeah. And really what I'm doing is to get the master bus of Pro Tools up to the level that I need it to be. I'm not overly limiting it, even though sometimes I'm limiting it kind of hard, but that's my limiter. I've used other limiters before, and I end up always going back to that L2. And then again, that's probably one of the first limiters I ever used for Pro Tools.
You made an interesting point. Like, you obviously like to hit it pretty hard, right?
Yeah, yep.
But I think that guys like you and I hear a finished product in our head, and we go for it. I remember the first time I started using multi-bus compression. I was mixing on a SSL K9000. I had four stereo buses, and everybody's record is like really, really loud, but there's no dynamics. And I'm like, I want my record to be competitive with that, but I want to have dynamics. So I thought, what if I put different things in different buses? And now people in DAWs do that all the time, with, like, you know, the drum aux and the keyboard aux and whatever. So you're not relying on that one stereo compressor. When I get to mastering at Sterling, they're like, wow, you really used a lot of compression. I'm like, oh, you think it's too much? I'm like, oh no, it was perfect.
Yeah.
There's no room for us to do it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think, you know, especially with compression, it's very dangerous. You can't undo it. But when you're comfortable and you know what you're going for, go for it, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned that. I mean, mainly because I'm delivering this stuff pretty much mastered when it gets to the client. Like, that's you know, because if I deliver it in a way that's not mastered, they're going to think that product doesn't sound correct. It doesn't sound professional. Like, when they're listening to it, they want to listen to it in their iTunes playlist or against whatever Spotify playlist that they're listening to, and it to sound competitive with whatever it is that they're listening to. I had a friend who wanted me to listen to the mixes that he was working on, and he sent me these files that were reading so incredibly low, like on the master bus. He also sent me 192K wave files of these mixes. And I was like, dude, I want to listen to this on my phone. And I want it to be as loud. And I want to listen to it on my earbuds and just walk around my apartment and listen to what you sent me. He's like, well, can't you listen to it in the studio? I'm like, you sent me mixes to listen to, didn't you? Like, we're not working on this together. Like, I'm not mastering it. Don't send me the full dynamic range mixes with the highest sample rate wave file. Like, let's put this in. If I'm listening to your mixes, I want to listen to them essentially in a consumer format. Not saying it needs to sound like a cassette, and not saying it needs to be low quality. I don't want to hear a 96K MP3 either, but send me a 320K MP3, something that's going to sound really good and something that's going to be competitive with the other music that I'm listening to so I can judge it appropriately. And I love the idea of what you're talking about, the multiple master fader. And that's something that's really easy to do in a DAW, you know, whether it's using the auxes, or sometimes I'll even, in Pro Tools, you know how you can assign outputs 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, all as individual stereo buses, but then send them all to the same physical output. So I'll do something like that. So it'll be like, I'll have a master fader for outputs 1 and 2, a master fader for outputs 3 and 4, a master fader outputs for 5 and 6, and send the physical output 9 and 10. And then when I bounce the disc, I'm bouncing the disc physical output 9 and 10, but I still have everything set up under individual master buses. And oftentimes what I'm doing is using as a starting point, I have one master fader, and then I'm essentially duplicating that master fader and then tweaking the limiter settings to the next stem, I guess is kind of what you're talking about.
What I do is some in analog. So I'm actually using a pair of distressors on my drum bus.
That's a great way to do it.
And I'm using like either Dangerous, or I'm using the Portico 2 on another bus. I have a couple of LA-3As, so one might be the lead vocal, the other might be the bass. And then that all goes through a benchmark audio converter back into Pro Tools.
Sick. That's a killer chain right there.
Greg, what about yourself? I know you have a little different experience now with your career. I kind of want to hear your input.
Speaking of the digital desk, we don't have a whole lot of extra plugins in the Avid profile. We have kind of the standard Bomb Factory stuff. And out of that, I reach for the LA-2A kind of on every vocal channel, or at least the lead vocals. Maybe not the background vocals. I might just use the channel strip compressor on the vocal channel.
Why?
But what's that? Why?
Tell us why.
Simplicity. This is something that's common to anyone who's working in the box. You can't see everything all the time. And I can't see. That's one of the things I miss about analog racks and stuff is you can look over at your rack and see, oh my God, background vocal 3 is just pegged. Because it's, you know, it's a plug-in, it's hidden, you don't see the meters anywhere unless you attention that channel. So I tend to save all the special stuff for just the lead vocals, because that's the thing I really concentrate on when I'm doing an air mix. You know, nobody's tuning in for snare drum. I used to reach for the 660, but that's a little more fiddly because it doesn't have the way the input, the output, and the threshold all work. Well, there is no output. There's just input and threshold, and it's a little fiddly to deal with, and I kind of just stepped away from using that and went to the LA2A. And then the other thing that I like to use is a multiband compressor on especially female vocals or anyone who cups the microphone.
Hey, here's my question for you. So you're saying you use a multiband on vocals?
Yes, on the lead vocal specifically.
Because that's something that I don't typically reach for, and I say this almost every year. Like I should really try and get into using multiband compressors. So where are you setting your crossover points? Like what frequencies are you trying to get at or not get at?
Usually somewhere in the 2K to 3K, 2K to 4K, 1K to 5K. I usually try and find the offending frequency of a singer. And it might be that it's the way their voice is pairing with a microphone. Like maybe you have a girl on a Beta 58 and the presence peak on a Beta 58 could be a little much. You know, if they get into a certain range where they start getting nasal or something, it just gets to be a little too piercing. And I'll find that frequency. And the funny part was I worked backwards to go forwards on this. We were at Good Morning America where it was an analog room. And I was thinking to myself, you know what I want? I want a hardware C4, the old Wave C4. That was the first one that I was using to kind of do that stuff. And I found this thing called a BSS 901. And I used that for a while. What that basically has is 4 filters that can be set for compression or expansion. You can get pretty fiddly with it. I would use that a bunch. And it was really good with the singers that are kind of like chesty and deep in the verse. And then they get screamy in the chorus. And instead of having to split the mic between 2 channels, because that's another way to work around it. Just EQ it 2 different ways and move your blend back and forth. But it's nice to just get all the work done on and worry about 1 fader.
Yeah.
You know, that and a de-esser, the ML4000, the de-essing on it, it doesn't move me. Like, on that desk, I just use the standard stock Avid de-esser, because that's what's available to us there.
When you said BSS, was that Brooks Siren?
Exactly. Yeah, it's a PA. It's a PA thing. But you can get there with the C6.
Dasan, what do you use for your vocals?
For the audiobook stuff that I've been doing recently, I find that the C4 parametric compressor, I've been using that a lot. Because sometimes there's a lot of stuff that's really resonant. I use it when there's stuff that I don't want to like all the way take out. Like I still want some of it, but I just take out a little bit so it's not so overbearing. And I find that the parametric compressor is like really good for that kind of stuff. So I've been using that a lot. But that's for like audiobook stuff. Mm. On like vocals that I'm doing for music stuff, I'm mostly using a lot of Logic stock stuff, and then like I really like the Waves doubler too. I like that a lot for like creating more space. It just like widening up stuff. So like I have a few.
Not to interrupt you. Have you messed with the Soundtoys Microshift at all?
See, I don't have the Soundtoys stuff.
They're on sale this week.
I think I saw that. They
also gave away a little Microshift for a while. I don't know if they still do that, but it was basically a version of Microshift. And similar to the Waves Doubler, that's an effect that I used to see people use in large format studios all the time. Every time you walked into a room, you'd see an AMS DMX set to 4 milliseconds, 7 milliseconds, plus 3, minus 3. And you'd see the H3000 set to dual shift, plus 3 cents, minus 3 cents. You know, one thing I never got into was the Publisan. But the point is that Waves Doubler is a old school studio effect. They've been doing that widener for years. And it's nice to see that. I mean, it's still very relevant.
The first song that I made where I like really like went through on the mix and used that one, I was like, these vocals sound huge. And then like ever since then, I've just been using it. Like, it depends. I also have this this plugin by Infected Mushroom, I think is the company. And they create this plugin called Wider, which is literally just like you can go, I think like 100% is like... it's like the regular stereo field, and then you can go up to like 200%. So I guess they're trying to like push it.
What happens when you pop that into mono though?
Yeah, see, that's the thing. I have some mixes where I have that on there, and actually working out of the old studio, I would switch it to mono because on the the C24 back there, you can turn it on mono. And I would reference it to make sure it sounds right, because sometimes, you know, you get that phasey sort of whatever.
100% right.
Yeah. But it's all a thing where I feel like I'd have to dial it back then. You know, if it sounds weird, then dial it in some other way so it sounds good in both.
You know, talk about using multi-band compressors on vocals. I'll tell you, I've done it, but not in the way that you guys have been describing. I discovered that you could actually, like, reverse compress, I guess. I don't know what you call it. But I would get a vocal that didn't have a lot of body. And rather than dragging the threshold, you know, the GUI down, if I dragged it up, it would actually push that frequency range more and give the vocal body.
Interesting.
And I was like, wow, what if I, you know, I was just messing around with it one day on something, maybe a bass or something, I don't know. And I just said, wow, that's kind of cool. Like, what if I did it on that vocal that needed all that body? And it worked. Just grab the GUI and drag it up instead of pushing it down, and you'll see. It'll just... that frequency range will get more excited. It's almost like an oral excitement, let's put it that way. The other thing that I do have a go-to vocal compressor. Most of the time it's an LA-2A on the insert, but I'll try other things. But 99% of the time, I will also bust to an 1176 with all the ratio buttons in and just crush it so it sounds like it's coming out of a tube of toothpaste, bring that up on a separate fader and blend that in.
So you bring up a good point of, first, what is an oral exciter? Mm-hmm. Because I'm sure some people may not really know what that is. And I remember those things were pretty fashionable for a hot second there. And they do make plug-in versions of that.
They do.
And second is, what is that trick of pushing all four buttons on the 1176? One thing I want to mention quickly about the 1176 is that is probably my favorite compressor of all time. And when I think of that Focusrite, what is it? I don't even remember which one is the D2 or the D3. But that Focusrite plugin, when I first started using it, that was my in-the-box 1176, because there really wasn't an 1176 for that. And mainly it's because 1176 is a great compressor, but it lets you adjust the attack and release. When you're talking about something like LA-2As, LA-3As, you know, and a lot of the compressors that you would find in a large format studio, you know, they didn't, even that 160X that I'm talking about, that doesn't have an adjustable attack and release time. And that's what I loved about the 1176. And really, when I look at like the TubeTech CL1B that I use, that's now my go-to vocal tracking compressor, I think of it as a much cleaner 1176. You know, it's 1176. It's not going to sound all crazy when you're compressing, when the vocalist hits it and it compresses minus 20 dB in the middle of a take. You know, where the 1176 will maybe start to sound a little artifacty, that thing doesn't really do that. But I still all think of them as 1176 style compressors.
Is that TubeTech, what's the sensor in it?
It's an opto. It's an optical compressor with a tube front.
So I used to always think of the CL1B as... as an LA-2A with adjustable attack and release times.
Exactly. Well, there you go. That's probably
right. But but that opto sensing, first of all, is a feedback system. So you're sensing after the fact instead of like really clamping down on stuff. But it's also a nonlinear response. So a release, I should say. So it's much more musical sounding. Like you said, Paul. I mean, you like turn around and you're crushing it. You know, at one point. But you don't really notice it. You see it on the meter, but you don't hear that artifact.
For people that maybe don't know what an optical compressor is, it's actually using a light sensing circuit where, you know, there's either, I guess in the older school ones, it was a light bulb. Now I think they use, you know, diodes that can get, you know, lighter and dimmer. And as if it gets brighter, there's more compression. As it gets dimmer, there's less compression. And just the way when you turn a light on and off, it takes a second for that light to dim. Mm-hmm. You know, the light bulb doesn't go out immediately. Right. It takes a little bit of time for that light to get dimmer. That's, you know, your sort of nonlinear response of the attack and the release. Right, it takes a little bit of time for that light to light up or get dimmer.
But that light's at the back end of the circuit, not the front end of the circuit. So it's even slower.
Interesting.
So especially like if you, like with a vocal, you hear all those attack things come through without it clamping down. Or an acoustic guitar, it's really another good thing to put a limiting the leveling amp, because you get all that that attack, you know, the pick on the string, and then the body like gets scooped up and, you know, codified in front of you.
I think that's a really great point you bring up as well, Rick, in that I have a tendency when we talk about compression, I used to deal with students with this and I talk to a lot of people about this. They're like, where do you set your attack and release time to? Now, I'm usually doing longer attack times and very fast release times because I want some of the transient to get through. If I'm compressing a lot, I don't want to be compressing a lot with like a 5 millisecond attack time because that is going to kill every single transient. Nothing is going to get through. But if I go like 30 milliseconds, which is, I think, a fairly long attack time, the transient gets through, but then the compressor starts to clamp down on it after the fact. Maybe it is because I'm used to the optical compressor and I'm looking for something a little bit like that that does, you know, I use a ton of compression, but I'm not using a ton of compression with very fast attack times because that's going to really set stuff back. Sometimes you want to do that, have a very fast attack
time. That's an excellent point. Like if you want to push something back in the sound field by clamping down on the attacks, it sounds like it's farther away.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's because it can't poke out because, you know, if someone's playing acoustic guitar and you have a very, very, you know, fast attack time, all those transients are not ever poking through. They're always getting pulled back. Whereas, you know, if it's 30 milliseconds would be a long time on an acoustic guitar, but every transient, every string hit is getting through that compressor. The compressor's reacting after the fact. That's really interesting.
Okay, so what's the difference between a modeled plugin and a standard DSP?
So, you know, talking about something like the UAs, you know, like the Universal Audio plugins that are modeled. To me, what I would say, for instance, like that Focusrite D2 and D3 are not modeled versions of the Focusrite EQ and compressor. To me, the modeled plugins, not only are they replicating something that already exists, it's really about THD or total harmonic distortion and how the analog circuit is actually reacting to and shaping the sound in addition to the actual effect. So for instance, something like, you know, I really love the UAD Neve EQs and just because I like the way the top end on like a, you know, any old school 70s Neve EQ is going to sound. There's a certain top end boost to get from that. But when also what they're doing is they're modeling the way the circuit is going to react to the signal in an analog way. Like there's certain pieces of gear. I think Dasan mentioned something the other day. We were talking to Greg about putting transformers in line. I think Rick could probably attest to this. It had to be one version of the TubeTech EQP1A that people would run stuff through and have the EQ in bypass just to run it through the actual unit, to run it through the transformers. And it's because it was giving you some kind of tone that, you know, it was adding additional harmonics to whatever was being run through that piece of gear. So to me, that's what the model plugins are doing.
We had a racket quad that had like 600 ohm transformers with XLR tails on it. And so what we would do is if the track didn't have like a lot of oomph to it, we would come out of Pro Tools and go into that and then go into the line amp on the SSL. And all of a sudden, poof, it would roll off your high end. You had to bring that back with your cue, but it would like put your track on steroids.
That is a fantastic idea. That's something we never had at any of the studios I ever worked at. And that is a great idea because when you think of like the most sought after older analog desks like Neve 8068 or even the APIs, you're talking about the input transformers or the input, you know, op amps or whatever it may be on that console that it's running through that's giving you that extra oomph, you know, even giving you that extra. And, you know, I should post a video of this of if you take a sine wave and you throw a bit of distortion on that sine wave, you will see all these additional harmonics pop up. And that is the distortion, you know. That is the, you know, when you see percent THD, that's what these circuits are giving you. To me, that's what model plugins are really doing. Besides being very detailed copies of the piece of gear that they're trying to model, it's really, you know, to me, it's modeling the THD. It's what that processor is doing to that signal in addition to, say, the actual compression that it does, in addition to the fact that it's an actual reverb. It's modeling the tone that piece of gear is going to give you in addition to the function of the piece of gear.
And I would just note, like for those who are uninitiated, when we talk about distortion, we're not talking about like, you know, bad audio.
Yeah.
We're talking about the fact that the tonality or the waveform itself is being distorted. It's being reshaped by, you know, back in those days, it was transformers or tubes or certain, you know, circuits like an API, the 2520 was the chip that gave it that sound. And so it's distorting the original signal, but in a nice way. And when you
in the slightest amount, yes, you know, yes. That is in the it's you know, it's not like a raging guitar amp distortion, but if you were to look at it on a scope, you would see those harmonics start to pop up, mm-hmm. and that's the tone that you're getting.
If you use a distressor, yeah. you can actually pop in second order harmonic distortion or third order harmonic distortion.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. sort of replicating a diode versus a triode tube, you know, in the guitar amp.
Yeah. I mean, I'm always referring to transformers, but yes, obviously worth pointing out, like you're saying, is that tube front ends of pieces of gear are going to do this for you as mm-hmm. well. It's going to add that little bit of tone to
while killing your transients. Like you said,
it's going to be second or third harmonic. Second or third order harmonics.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is what we feel, at least, you know, people that grew up in our generation, you know, that's that warmth that people.
But it is, you know, again, I'll always tell people, if you're going to be recording an orchestra, you don't want the flattest mics with the cleanest mic pres. You want mics that are going to offer you some character and mic pres that are going to offer you some tone. Mm-hmm. And a room that's going to offer you some great acoustics, but that's if you can apply that to, you know, if you have, you know, a synth, you know, say you have like an older analog synth, if you run that older analog synth through a mic pre that's going to give you some tone, that analog synth is going to sound even fatter than it's going to sound if you're running it through just like, you know, a mic, like a cheap mic pre or even a high end mic pre that is designed to be as flat as possible. Right. It's not always what you want. You want something that's going to give you some harmonics or some oomph.
Yeah.
I had a question. Also, when you're talking about modeled versus DSP, do you mean something more along the lines of where you're saying modeled is a convolution? Because there's a lot of equipment that's convolution. You know, your Altiverb reverbs, where you're shooting a piece of gear and you're taking an impulse response through the piece of gear. And there's some weird stuff out there. Like, for example, Waves makes it. Where you can like run it through an EQ and you can capture that EQ curve and then apply that curve to your audio that it's going through. And I've seen people do other things where they'll take an impulse response of every channel of a desk and use that. It's not really a reverb time, but that's looking at the transient response of the desk and mm-hmm. you're applying that to your channels.
That's a very cool idea. Yeah.
Does anybody use Plugin Alliance stuff at all?
I just have the BrainWorks BX control.
In a lot of their plugins, they have this thing that's called tolerance modeling technology. And basically, so to go back to your console thing mm-hmm. example. So let's say there's 120 different electrical components in a channel strip. And they're all built within a certain tolerance of a spec.
Right.
Which means that even from the get-go, channel 1 and channel 2 and channel 3 and channel 4 all sound slightly different. And as they age differently.
Waves is doing that with their nonlinear summer. Same thing.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I hate to be such a Waves whore. It's just that I bought in early and they keep taking my money.
Yeah.
They make some cool stuff, though.
Let's go into reverbs a little bit. I just kind of want to keep it simple at first. Some reverb plugins that you guys like to go to, and then we'll go off that.
I think Greg brought up a great point of talking to something like Altiverb. Like that, when I think of it's funny, I'm about to talk about Altiverb first, because that's definitely not the first one that I reach for, even though I do really, really like Altiverb. But what's worth noting is they are sampled acoustic spaces that you're loading into Altiverb. So really, it doesn't have to be Altiverb. It can be any plugin that also samples acoustic spaces. I first got into Altiverb because I was working on, it was a film mix, not a music film mix, like an actual, like, you know, mixing the dialogue and the sound effects and whatnot for a film. And it was because it was an independent film that was, most of it was shot in a convenience store, and there was a lot of lines that were recorded after the fact, like ADR. And we had to make those lines that were recorded in the studio sound like they were in the convenience store. So you just dial up convenience store in Altiverb, and sure enough, it sounds like you're in a convenience store. Then I started getting into more using the, you know, like Disney Hall or any of the sampled acoustic spaces in Altiverb. But Altiverb is an expensive plugin. I really like taking my own impulse responses with Altiverb. It makes the process very, very simple. But you don't have to have Altiverb. You can use any plugin that is using sampled spaces. It's an expensive plugin and it's nice. I do like the impulse responses of the pieces of gear, you know, that they have with Altiverb. What I also like is going back to Dasan talking about Logic. I've had times where a client does a rough mix in Logic and falls in love with the, you know, with the Platinum Verb or whatever is it that they're using in Logic. And now I have to continue working on that track in Pro Tools. So I'll take an impulse response in Logic of that reverb, load it into Altiverb, and then use that Logic reverb in Pro Tools through Altiverb, which to me works. You know, that's one nice thing to use a convolution reverb for. Tim was talking about, and you mentioned Dverb earlier.
Yeah.
Dverb gets a lot of shit. People talk a lot of shit about that plugin. And I think one of the big reasons is because when you first open Dverb, it's set to a pretty lousy preset. It's like a very, very long church. I think Dverb is one of the most underrated algorithmic reverbs out there. Again, that's probably the first reverb I ever used in Pro Tools. One of the biggest songs of my career was mixed with Focusrite D2 and D3 plugins, the Waves L2 on the master bus, again, because that's what I do almost every time. There wasn't anything else too exotic other than that. And the primary reverb was Dverb. This was a huge hit single. And the only delays that were used were the stock Avid delays. So, and that Focusrite D2 and D3 are made by Avid. So you're talking about essentially like stock Avid plugins. And this mix beat this huge mix engineer who was pissed that I beat him. I don't want to name his name, but he's got this place where he also talks about this type of stuff, if you know that guy.
Yeah. Enough said.
Yeah. But anyway, for sure, I mean, I use Dverb for its plates. I love the Dverb plates. And that's one thing I'll set up almost all the time is a short plate and a long plate. And when you're setting reverbs, here's a great trick that I learned back in the old days, is to set that reverb time to a musical value. The same way you'll set a delay to something like an eighth note or a 16th note, I'll go in and set my Dverb to an eighth note or a 16th note. I'll quickly calculate using Pro Tools or however it is I got to calculate it. If the tempo's at, you know, 107, then I'm going to see what's a 16th note at 107 or what's an eighth note at 107. Set the Dverb plate to that millisecond time. That's a really killer way to set your reverbs real quick.
Are you talking reverb time or pre-delay?
Reverb time. Reverb time.
And pre-delay.
You know, and pre-delay. You're right. And pre-delay. You know, I would preach that to students because a lot of times they would have trouble. They're like, well, where do I set this reverb time to? And I would tell them the story of the delay charts that we'd find in the back of control rooms, and you'd be able to look up the tempo and look at the milliseconds for all the different tempos, and you'd walk around the room, and that's the way you'd set up all your reverb times. You know, using that delay chart.
60,000 divided by your tempo would give you a quarter note, yeah. And then, you know, go from there. But it was nice to have those charts. They were really handy. They were really handy.
Yeah.
You know, what's a 16 note triplet? You know, oh, there it is. You know, boom. You know, it was right there.
We should put one of I'm going to put one of those on the website, a delay chart for people to download. I remember I made one for SAE students a while back, which was just an Excel spreadsheet because I got tired of telling them to just do a search in Google Images for a delay chart. You know, again, Dverb is a great algorithmic reverb. What else do I use? I use the lexicon stuff for reverbs just because I would always want to go back to using something like a 480 or a 224.
UA just came out with a 480.
I've never gotten into the modeled 480 or the model 224 and all that. But yeah, I know they came out with it. I always went into, you know, it was like the Lexicon plugin version. Greg, I remember you and I talking about this a long, long time ago. This is before Lexicon was making plugins for Pro Tools. And I was like so missing a Lexicon reverb when I first started mixing in the box. I had considered getting like, Lexicon had made their audio interface and the they new had verb reverb card. Plugins for it. And I had considered getting one of those because I was so desperately wanting a Lexicon reverb. And I remember you thought that was a really silly idea. For me to get, but that was because you thought it was a silly idea because I was talking about getting another interface and system just to use a reverb.
Right.
And that's probably when I started to realize, you know, Dverb is super useful and don't think of it as a secondary plugin. I mean, that plugin the song that I worked on was Keisha Cole, Let It Go, which was, that song could not get off the radio. And every time I listened to it, I'd crack up because I'm like, that's Dverb plate all over that record. And it's the Avid stock delays, like the stock delay that comes with Avid. And they're just, there's an EQ after every one of those delays, and the EQ is just EQ'd like crazy to make it sound interesting. And there might even been a distortion plugin, like Amp Farm or something after those delays to make it sound characterful. Mm-hmm. But that's a great version of a song that was, you know, a huge hit song that also got mixed by a very top mix engineer, and my mix beat the hell out of his, and it was mostly stock plugins, you know, like more or less off-the-shelf plugins, wasn't anything too exotic, that's for sure.
I have to admit a fondness for UA's 224.
It's funny, going back to, you know, 480 or 224, I always preferred the 224 over the 480. I thought it was a little bit grittier, and I liked the grittiness of it.
Do you remember the Lex 200?
Yeah.
Very nonlinear, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I remember like talking to some design engineers and going like, you know, how come you never like put any of those in some of the later boxes? Or, oh, you know, it sounds much cleaner, much more pristine. I'm like, yeah, that's my point, you know?
Yep.
And then when I saw UA made the AMS RMX reverb unit and I was like, I'm in.
You know, it's great that you mentioned the RMX. I always thought of D-Verb as real similar to the RMX, maybe because it has similar presets with the, you know, plate, nonlinear, hall, room. Like, I always, in my mind, because that's another reverb unit that I always felt was great, but the presets maybe were, you know, you really had to tweak an RMX, in my opinion, to get it to sound like something. And I always think of D-Verb the same way. Like, if you go to those presets, you're going to be like, ah, I don't know about this reverb. But if you go in and you tweak it, and sometimes tweaking it is just setting that, you know, the crossover point and setting the reverb time to something that makes sense.
Hey, Greg.
Yo.
Before, I wanted to ask what was a model plugin versus standard DSP, but did I ask what's a model plugin versus impulse response?
No, you didn't. Forget. That's why I was curious. Because there's two things. People are modeling. There's the plugins where people are making a plugin that's nothing else has ever been like it before. And then there's the, you know, I want something that's exactly like this piece of gear that I've always used. And the thing that I'm doing a lot more is I'm still trying to get back to the good old days. I tend to reach for a lot of stuff that is familiar to me. I do a lot of SSL channel strips, the SSL bus compressor, you know, where I'll reach for a Neve. I have a GML EQ. So a lot of what I do is to get back to thinking less, relying less on mousing in the screen and more on twisting knobs. My Pro Tools setup is based around a Pro Tools dock and Avid Artist Mix. So I try to look less and close my eyes more and feel things. And a lot of the plugins, like Paul was saying, Altiverb, I bought into Altiverb, and I reach for the things that tend to be what I've always reached for. Lex 480 presets, EMT 250 presets, EMT 140 presets. And then there's a really nice AKG BX20 impulse response. And I tend to use those reverbs kind of over and over again. Kind of like going back to the old days of you would walk into a room and, you know, the 480 would be on sends 1 and 2. The 224 would be on send 3. The SPX90 would be on send 4. And the 224s, I mean, not the 2, the PCM42s would be on, you know, Q left and Q right or something, where it was like, or bus 1, 2, 30, 31, 32. Like, you just kind of always set those things up, and then you think about it less, and you just kind of reach for, oh, what's, you know, does it need this? No, that's not right. What's this? And that's not right. That's this. And then everything else is like unfuckalizers. I have a really nice multiband compressing EQ by a German company called Hofa.
Yeah, I love that. I love those guys.
That Hofa IQ EQ, you can set, it'll do, you know, it'll do boost and cut and whatnot for your EQ, but it'll also do dynamics-based processing, and the side chain doesn't have to be the same frequency that you're working on, which is fucking amazing. So if I have to unfuck somebody's master, where they've gotten their kick and their bass balance is all whacked, I can go in and I can find, oh, here's a frequency in the kick drum that's not in the bass guitar, but the place where the bass and the kick drum are fighting each other, I can dip that when they play.
The song, Rick was just asking, what's your go-to for reverb?
Yeah, so when Paul was talking about like Altiverb, I downloaded Altiverb, but I don't know. I feel like I don't even use it that much. I have the like Space Designer's Logic's like convolution reverb. And that one is like shit. Essentially, yeah, exactly.
And it's fucking great.
Yep. And then with Apple's got a built-in program where you can create impulse responses.
Yep.
So like I found myself using that and then just using Space Designer. Then also Logic got this, I think it was like recent, like a couple of months ago, they had this this reverb called Chromaverb. And I feel like that one's also really good. That one, I feel like with Space Designer, I always find myself going for these like cold reverb tones, and then Chromaverb, that one's like really colorful as well. So like that one, I use them for different things. So like depending on what I'm going for, I'll pick one or the other. And then for vocals, I find myself going a lot to what's that one? The Fab Filter one. What is it called? It's like R or something or whatever. But the Fab Filter reverb for vocals is really good too. So those are the main ones that I usually use. I don't find myself into like Platinum Verb or like Silver Verb that much, but mostly the stock Logic stuff I feel like is where I'm always going for reverbs.
Yeah, for sure. I think the Logic reverbs sound great, honestly. I think they do.
Yeah, they're great. I always find myself like, I feel like I'll throw a Logic reverb. I'll like go out whatever parallel and then just throw like an echo after it or something like that and then mess with the mix on there. And then usually it's pretty good. And then like I'll just go ahead and maybe do something like the auto filter to give some panning effects or something like that. But like that stuff sounds good and you don't have to do like a lot with it.
Logic saves you $700.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that because they have the impulse response utility, and it's true. Like you really can't get away with using, you know, Space Designer in place of Outdoor. Of course, it's not gonna have the same. The one thing I do like about Outdoor is its library is pretty awesome.
It's huge. Like,
but I used to tell people if you're having issues with Space Designer's library, there's tons of free, you know, impulse response sites out there where you can download impulse responses and get a really interesting library of impulse responses for Space Designer and for Altaverb for that matter. You can import them into either program. But
yeah, there was a plugin called Seventh Heaven that I demoed for a bit. It's a software version of the Bricasti.
Oh, damn.
And the
I'm
funny
Googling
part
that right now.
And there's a light version that's only like $69. But here's the thing. Somebody shot the Bricastis and I compared the two, and you know, I've already got Altaverb, and let me tell you, I couldn't tell them apart.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And it was interesting. It was an interesting, like, oh, I'd be interested in this, but shit, I've already got it. I sat and A-B'd, and I'm like, I can't tell the difference, you know, one over the other. But it was also an interesting thing for like, hey, if you want to get into the game for $69.
Has anybody used Convolution to create a whole new track? I was mixing this song and there was like this, you know, big guitar power chord thing happening. And I put Altiverb on it, but I convoluted it with a background vocal that was just doing,
Oh, yeah, that's pretty interesting.
You know, basically, yeah, I like that idea. Sort of like granular synthesis where you're taking a little bit of this and a little bit of that and you mix them together and you get a whole other sound altogether.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're that's practically cool. Vocoding it.
In a way, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you're doing it. You're doing things with things that were not intended to be that way, and that's what's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Convolution is a pretty cool thing.
While we're on the subject of reverbs, because you were talking about inexpensive reverbs, one that, I mean, if, you know, a lot of new people are maybe going to be familiar with these, but is super popular that I find to be really, really worth the money. They're like $50 a pop is the Valhalla reverbs. And to me, they sound like, I mean, first of all, they sound like modern hip hop records. Like I feel like that's what that reverb is being used on a lot of those records, but they're damn good. Their room is great. Their plate is great. They're really, really solid plugins for $50.
Yeah.
If you're only going to spend $50 on a reverb plugin, that might be that's a good choice for sure. Or yep. Just, you know, I mean, they're different than reverb. And maybe they do sound a little bit more like the Logic reverbs where they're a little bit like, I don't know, the Logic reverbs are a little bit shinier to me, you know?
One of the professors over at Eastman teaches film scoring. And that's one of the things he recommends to all his kids. Get the Valhalla. It's amazing. But our go-to is Fat Plate, you know?
Yeah.
Because it's like, hey, exactly. we've got Fat Plate. We've both got a physical version and we've got the model plugin.
Yeah, I'm drawn to plates a lot. Like I like the UA-140.
Yeah, yeah.
Yep.
But I like similar to that, but not the same. In Altaverb, it's the Wendy Carlos plates, which I've been using forever. And they sound to me like the good Hit Factory plates.
Yeah.
How many plates did you guys have?
There were a lot.
It was at least two per room at one point. And it is true that you did. What was interesting about what I learned when I first got there was in 237, the older building, they had a bunch of plates in the basement. They also had echo chambers in the basement that were left over from Bell Sound, which was pretty amazing. And it sucks that that stuff never got sampled. Can you believe we never made convoluted?
Those chambers sounded like ass.
They did, but it would have been cool to have them.
Yeah. You know,
what was more fascinating was actually seeing them is that they were little tiny, like cement block rooms.
And they were tiny.
Yeah, you didn't really expect them to be that, but that's what they were. But what I learned there was it really is true. Like one plate was not another plate, was not another plate, was not another plate. That there was like, okay, plate like three is good and plate seven is good and the rest of them suck.
Yep.
And that was the big complaint in the newer building was that it was the plates were assigned to the room. You couldn't pick the plate.
Right.
So if Studio 3 had a shitty plate, you just were stuck with the shitty plate.
At Media Sound, they had the plate room and it had like eight plates in it.
Right, and you probably patched them, right?
Yeah, but you'd go in, but they were assigned to rooms, but they were patchable, right? Mm-hmm. And you'd go into Studio A and it'd be like, you know, I'm about to start a session, and like, there's patch cords in the patch, but then it'd be like a big note, like don't pull these, and it would be like tie line from Studio B, you know, grab it, stealing Studio A's plate from Mixon, you know, and they
You know, I think it's worth saying because there's, you know, people are probably used to seeing the plate button on a reverb plugin, but what is an actual plate? But, you know, it's a piece of sheet metal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, the sound is actually going through the piece of sheet metal, and there's pickups on either side of that sheet metal that's picking up the sound bouncing around through that piece of metal. You know, you can actually, if you walk up to an echo plate, first of all, they're very big. They're like the size of this console, but very thin. And you can hear the sound going through the sheet metal as when you walk up to it. If you yell into it while it's being used, they'll hear it in the control room. Yeah, it's very much a physical piece of equipment. If you kick it, it's going to make a lot of noise.
Oh, my God.
I was at a studio mixing. As I'm mixing along, I started to hear the sounds of a party.
Yeah.
And I'm
like, fucking record that shit.
What's going on?
Yeah.
So I started to the assistant. I said, where do you have that plate? And like, oh, it's out in the lounge up in the ceiling. And I go out there, they're having a party, a birthday party, underneath the plate.
Yeah.
Awesome.
I'm like, you can't put that in the lounge. You got to put that somewhere where people aren't. Real estate in Manhattan being what it is, they couldn't do it. You know, they didn't have an additional space.
So here's maybe what I think, and you tell me what you guys think. That because I feel like we've covered so much ground that we should consider doing a part two because we haven't even really talked specifically about delays.
Yeah,
I was just thinking,
you know,
that.
Literally. And I feel like if we start talking about delays, the way we've been having this conversation, we're going to start getting into tape machines and actually, you know, we can start to talk about getting into chambers and how chambers work and how you can use the live room of a studio as an echo chamber. Mm-hmm. Maybe we should do this as a part two.
Yeah.
Like our next podcast would be getting into, physical spaces. We could talk more about, you know, using rooms as chambers, talk about tape machines as delays and that sort of thing. How do you guys feel about that?
Yeah, sounds good.
Yeah.
Kind of wrapping it. I mean, what do you think?
I agree. I was like, there's a lot of questions that I started thinking of.
I think we got a lot for episode two, and I think we got a good plan for episode three.
Yeah. And the song. Definitely come back, man.
Oh, yeah. And I had some questions too, but we'll have to save them.
That sounds great. Well, thank you, guys. I think this was an awesome episode too. I look forward to episode three where we'll continue this conversation.
Awesome conversation.
All right. Yeah. See you guys.
Right on. Talk soon.
Thanks, guys. See you.
The Pro Fools Podcast, episode one, is brought to you by The Residence Studios. The Residence Studios is a destination studio located in central Long Island, 1 hour from Manhattan, 1 hour to the Hamptons. We offer a state-of-the-art recording and mixing studio, photo and video facilities with hotel-like amenities, 5 minutes from the beach and minutes away from Long Island's major attractions. Contact us at theresidencestudios@gmail.com or Instagram at theresidencestudios. I hope you've enjoyed the Pro Fools podcast as much as we've enjoyed bringing it to you. There's no one right answer on how to make a great recording. To make great recordings, you must do your best and work your hardest. Don't be afraid to make mistakes, but be sure to quickly get over them and most importantly, learn from them. Because a wise man knows what a fool he's been. Make sure to like, subscribe, and turn on the bell so you can be notified when we post on YouTube. Follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. You can donate via PayPal at theprofoolspodcast@gmail.com and at the ProFools Podcast at Patreon. Email us, questions and otherwise, at theprofoolspodcast@gmail.com. Check out our website, theprofoolspodcast.com.